This podcast is proudly sponsored by Asus, makers of notebooks that are easy to learn, work, and play with. These days, notebooks have a lot more power than the Atom and Celeron-powered mini PCs from over a decade ago, and the Asus ZenBook 15 is one of those notebooks. The ZenBook 15 is sleek and weighs just under 2 kilograms, but it's not a delicate flower. Asus has put this notebook through the brutal test regime needed to acquire military-grade certification. This includes shock tests, vibration tests, tests in extreme temperatures, and tests at high altitudes. If you're looking for a notebook with elegant design, but one that will also stand the test of time, you can't go wrong with the Asus ZenBook 15. Visit www.asus.com for more information. Everybody, and welcome to another edition of the AfriCast. My name is Brendan Lotz, and joining me today is Clinton Matos.
It's me. Hello, everybody.
And Robin Lichetti.
Howdy.
How are you guys doing this week? Looking forward to the weekend?
Still alive. That's all you can ask nowadays, I suppose.
I'm very dry.
Dry?
Got no water in these parts of the world.
Oh, gosh.
So it's been a tough week in the Chetty household.
Yeah, I can imagine. Water's kind of important, I've heard. I've heard that humans kind of need it to survive. Otherwise, they're dealt a critical hit and things go badly.
You're not brilliant. For the past 2 months, I've actually have had to buy water from stores because the water in my taps is undrinkable for some reason. I need to take it to a lab. I don't even know what I'm supposed to do. It comes out like yellow, and it tastes like chemicals. So that's been a nice use of my money, paying for something I already pay for.
I'm sure you can...
Alex Jones was right.
Oh, gosh.
Sorry, Brendan?
I'm sure you can go to a university, and maybe they'll test it for you. Can you not do that?
University's closed.
Oh, yeah.
Lockdown, and I don't even know if like the semester's in... You know, session. I have no idea. I need to do something because water is not expensive for a little while, but it really adds up.
Yeah.
I'm still using it to like wash the dishes and bathe and stuff like that. But just now, it's making me ill that I'm doing that. So
if Clinton suddenly mutates, we know why.
I hope I get a superpower, not one of those boring things like a serious disease.
I don't know how to segue from that into the first news story, so consider this awkward segue that segue. This week, Mozilla published a report that took a look at some really concerning trends within YouTube. Basically, the report leveraged crowdsourced data that was collected through an extension for Firefox and Google Chrome called Regrets Reporter. And essentially what this allowed somebody to do is if you were on YouTube and you were recommended a video that was kind of one of like a conspiracy theory or harmful misinformation, things like that, folks could report this video to report this instance to Mozilla. And essentially what Mozilla was trying to find was whether YouTube's recommendations was pushing people to extremist and misinformation and flat-out wrong content. And they found some really concerning figures. For instance, 71% of reports suggested 71% of reports for questionable content on YouTube came through recommended videos by YouTube's algorithm. In comparison, when searching for a particular topic, these videos only appeared in 7.4% of reports. So Mozilla is very vague about what it terms regrets. Basically, it can encompass a whole bunch of things from misinformation, fear-mongering about COVID-19, hate speech. They kept it purposefully vague so that they could identify what, number one, what people find regretful in terms of content, and also to make sure that their data was sort of accurate, right? Because, well, not accurate, more widespread, because what you find regretful and what I find regretful are two different things. But generally, there is a happy medium, and this report kind of finds where that medium is. But what I found really strange was things like the videos that folks were watching and the videos that they were then recommended to them. For instance, one volunteer was watching an Art Garfunkel cover where he was performing a song with his son, and was recommended a video about how a Trump debate moderator was exposed, how the media bias is reaching breaking point, and just really fringe sort of stuff, right? It's like, we won the election type of things. It's really concerning to see how this these pieces of content are spread through YouTube. And a lot of this content also breaks YouTube's guidelines, which is just really weird. Although we do know that you can kind of sneak things through if you aren't a very well-followed channel. You can kind of get away with a lot of things before YouTube takes notice. The recommendation to fix this, however, isn't really that simple, because essentially YouTube would need to decipher the black box that is its algorithm. And that's easier said than done. So it's a really interesting report. A lot of stories about how people find content that they probably don't want to see on YouTube. I recommend giving this a read and checking out. And maybe just be cognizant of what YouTube is recommending you. And you can tell YouTube to not recommend certain types of videos from certain channels to you. So if you do spot them, just take that action. But yeah, really, really interesting.
Confirms what...
Yeah, it kind of reminds me...
Go ahead, Robin.
I was going to say, it kind of reminds me of a outro clip that a Daily Show alum, Samantha Bee, likes to use on her videos, where it says, if you want to be converted by extremists, just leave the autoplay feature on YouTube on and see what happens.
Yeah, this kind of confirms what a lot of people not know, but what a lot of people suspect. And I mean, I can back this up anecdotally, because even though I try to prune my personal account as much as possible, my dad has a laptop that he just watches. You know, he's 65 and he enjoys cars, and you know, last night he's watching clips from old westerns. That's the kind of stuff he likes. But he still gets recommended absolutely, now I was gonna swear there, absolutely insane nonsense, like, you know, the vaccine is bad and 5G gives you cancer and stuff about Trump, that he won the election, all of this stuff. And none of it is at all, I mean, related to what my dad's searching. And that's not me thinking, oh, my dad's a saint, he'd never look it up. I can see on his past searches, you know, Jeep Cherokee engine, which engines break down the most.
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood original movie. He's not searching for this stuff, but it's being recommended to him constantly. It isn't once or twice, it's all of the time. And I want to add something on top of that. He actually doesn't have a Google/YouTube account. He's using YouTube without an account. So as far as I know, it shouldn't be tracking him and recommending him videos on a long period of time, but it's probably using cookies to do that regardless. It's probably not even depending on an actual account to do that, which is infuriating.
Yeah, so I went and had a look myself, and this past week I've been purposefully watching more political content or politically themed content on YouTube. And I don't know if it's just a case of me having forced the YouTube algorithm to kind of only serve me certain types of content, which is generally technology news and food stuff. But I haven't really seen this extremist content. But then again, like I say, I've kind of pushed YouTube to only recommend me certain things. And every time something unrelated pops up, I'm very cognizant of it. And Mark, please don't recommend this to me again, or please don't show me video content from these channels. So I think that being a sort of passive YouTube viewer doesn't really help you in these sorts of things. And you need to be a lot more active about what you're seeing, what's being recommended to you. And if you see these videos that are questionable, I mean, a lot of these videos use clickbait titles, right? I mean, I'm just looking at my YouTube recommendations here right now. And I mean, all of these titles are clickbaity, because you want people to click your video, right? So yeah, I think just be more cognizant about what you are consuming through YouTube. And yeah, hopefully you won't run into some really strange stuff. Who knows? Robin, what have you...
Probably will regardless.
Yeah. Robin, what have you got for us this week?
Yeah, so something, I guess, a little bit more happy. So people may not know about Formula E. It is, I guess, the electric vehicle version equivalent of Formula One, and it seems to be gathering momentum. We do cover electric vehicles on our website purely because they are really interesting. But we covered this story because it has a local context, and that is that the city of Cape Town will be hosting one of the rounds for the ABB FIA Formula E World Championship next year.
Say that three times fast.
Yeah, I had to hear really, really slowly. So the bid was put forward by Jaguar and its partner E-Movement on behalf of the city of Cape Town. And yeah, it was successfully accepted. And now the city has been added to the 2022 schedule starting in February. That said, it is one of the cities that is subject to change purely for the fact that we have a global pandemic. Yeah. Anyone that's followed the news this week has seen that our third wave infections and death rate is very concerning. So we're not too sure what the situation will be like next year in February. That said, currently Cape Town is listed for the third event in the calendar, which is round four. That doesn't make sense. That's because rounds one and two are both in Saudi Arabia. But we have a full list of the current schedule for Cape Town. It's happening on the 26th of February, 2022. And hopefully by that stage, there will be the ability to have people actually watch these Formula E vehicles race around a track in person. Obviously, if... the situation is still quite dire as far as COVID-19 goes. That probably won't be the case, but it is at least good news to see that South Africa is once again becoming more notable in the motorsport space. I mean, F1 back in the day, I think 1993 was the last time a Grand Prix was held in South Africa, and I think it was Kyalami. But yeah, South Africa has a rich history as far as motorsport and racetracks go. So if electric vehicles are coming to South Africa, then hopefully it'll be a good thing for the country and potentially a bit more conversations around EVs in general, because I think that's been a hot topic. Our inability to get more of them into the country and our power utility not really helping in that regard either. So yeah, something to perhaps diarize if you are in the City Bowl next year, February.
Did they mention...
Great, Brendan.
Sorry, Robin. Did they mention what track they would be racing at?
That was not mentioned. It could potentially be one that is
a street circuit,
a city track. Yeah. So. So I see that the London, for example, is listed as one of the venues. So not Silverstone. They specifically mentioned London, Seoul in South Korea as well. So it looks like they might be actually using the cities themselves as a racetrack, essentially, which could be really, really cool.
I mean, that is common. I mean, if you've never watched Formula E before, they will basically race anywhere. One of my favorite tracks is in Germany, which is it's basically an old airfield that they've converted into a track. It's a really fun track as well. But yeah, I am curious if they do this in a street circuit, because personally speaking, Cape Town's roads aren't very nice to drive on, especially like the back routes and stuff. So I'm curious to see what track they race at.
Well, I'm hoping it's not going to be that uncompleted highway.
That would be hilarious.
If you put a ramp at the end of it, it would be awesome.
Have you seen how those cars fly already?
Like, yeah, the ramp would just make it better, Brendan. It would be awesome. You guys have no imagination. I was just going to say, I've always been jealous of the stories my dad told me about him watching F1 in South Africa, and it's always been a completely bizarre thing for someone to say that we had F1 in South Africa. It's like when people tell me South Africa used to have nuclear bombs, it's something that I can't really comprehend this country having. So this is really good news. I don't know if I'd go as far as to spending a lot of money flying to Cape Town and watching it, but I mean, maybe. Who knows where we'll be in a few months. Maybe I will do that just to support it. It's really cool, and I'm happy to see it happening, because they've been trying to get this going for years. I've been getting emails from Jaguar South Africa for years saying, you know, we're almost there. We're going to get it soon. And now they actually got it. You know, persistence. It's great to hear.
Jaguar, if you have a few spare tickets, you always have a few people that you can hit up.
Yeah, we'd love to. We'd love to cover the events.
100%.
Clinton, you've got some news about the new Switch. With many quotation marks around the word new.
I can't believe what's happened. So I just want to give some quick context. Ever since the original Switch launched in 2017, there have been rumors here and there about some kind of upgraded model and 4K support and this and that. And the only things we've really gotten over the years is the Switch Lite, which is going in the opposite direction, being a cheaper one. Got a lot of hmms there. A cheaper version of the Switch. And then, I think it was 2 years ago now, there was an upgrade to the CPU, but it wasn't made to increase any power of the Switch. The upgraded CPU just used less power. So it was essentially a battery upgrade more than anything else. So people were fervent of some kind of Switch Pro being released, and they said, here's the new Switch. And the name of this new thing is the OLED model. OLED model. The model isn't even capitalized, the word model. It's the most half-assed thing I've ever seen in tech. If you guess that they just changed the screen, you're right, kind of. So the screen has been increased in size slightly. It used to be 6.2 inches, and now it's 7 inches. And now this is something we don't really know right now. The old resolution of the Switch was 720p. I've seen rumors that the new one is also 720p, but Nintendo themselves haven't said that yet. So that's kind of up in the air right now, but most people are agreeing that all they've really done is increased it by 0.8 inches and made it OLED, but they haven't increased the resolution. So even though the screen might look better, the resolution is actually worse because it's stretched over a larger screen. It boggles the mind why they've done this. And the only other changes have been, there's three other changes, right? The internal storage from 62 gigs is now 64 gigs. Wow. What a change. 64 gigs. The kickstand on the back of the Switch is notoriously bad. They've improved it. I think that's the biggest actual change. Instead of being a dinky little, I think it's like 1.5 centimeter stand. The stand now stretches the entirety of the back of the Switch, and it's adjustable. The old stand only had one position. This one has multiple positions. And they've been very vague about this. There's enhanced audio. You know, there's, again, no details. Enhanced audio. So that's it. It's coming out soon, in 8th of October. It will also be out in South Africa on 8th October. But we don't know the price. We can guess. Now, I just want to bring this up, right? The original Switch, $300. At the time of writing, that's around 4,300 Rand. How much does the Switch cost in South Africa? 8,000 Rand. Almost double, right? This new one is $350. So just keep that in mind. In America, the price difference is $50. And at the time of writing, $350 is about 5,000 Rand. Most people, myself included, are betting that this new one is going to be 10,000 Rand. I'm 100% comfortable saying that. I can almost guarantee that the Switch will be 10,000 Rand, or it will be something like 9,950 or something like that. I'm almost guaranteed that it's going to be twice the price of America again. I don't want to get into a whole conversation about this, about how core prices is things are high. I'll just link to the stories you've written. And I'll also mention that just today, just this morning, Core, who's the official distributor of Nintendo in South Africa, sent out an email to its subscribers of its newsletter saying, reply to this email to express your interest in the OLED Switch. I have no idea why they're doing this. They should just announce the price, but I'm sure next week we'll get some price, and I'm willing to bet cold hard cash it's going to be very close to 10,000 Rand.
I do wonder why Nintendo decided to do this now. Why release the Switch now? I mean, like you say, Clinton, I mean, it's really just the screen upgrade and the kickstand. Like, I think folks were expecting more from this, and I don't know, it's kind of disappointing to now just have a what feels like an afterthought being paraded as a new console that is going to fetch a premium.
I don't see who this is for. Now, even me, even me, I only play the Switch handheld. That's the preferred way I use the Switch, right?
Mm.
This should, in theory, be aimed at me by increasing how good the screen looks in handheld mode. But I don't see the point of it if, again, they don't increase the resolution. Mm. And I don't have the greatest eyesight. I wear glasses. I'm a bit blind. And in a lot of games, I'm playing on the Switch, and I'm just like, this looks so blurry. The text sucks. I wish I had a bigger screen, but the tiny increase they've given us, 0.8 inches, it might make all the difference. You know, I'm judging something before it's out, and hopefully we'll get a review unit. But that 0.8 inches makes such a little difference if it's not at least 1080p.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the OLED model. They didn't give it a snappy name. I can't believe it. It will be out in a few months. We'll have to judge it then.
The all-new ASUS ZenBook 15 sports Intel's 11th gen processors as well as NVIDIA graphics. Whether you're working on massive spreadsheets or even 4K video, the ZenBook 15 takes it in a stride, especially with up to 16 gigabytes of DDR4 memory and 1 terabyte of NVMe PCI 3.0 storage. The ZenBook's display can also be rotated 360 degrees thanks to the precision-engineered ErgoLift hinge. So whether you're presenting to the team or simply kicking back watching a movie, the ZenBook 15 moves the way you need it to. Visit www.asus.com to learn more.
Cool. That's our news for this week. Let's get on to something a bit meatier. Fair Work Project SA released its SA 2021 ratings report, which takes a look at the gig economy and how they treat their workers. Robin, do you want to kick us off here? Because you covered this, and there were some interesting findings.
Yeah, so I think for a bit of context first, the Fair Work Project, as the name would imply, kind of looks at how fairly workers are treated on digital platforms and services across the globe. For the South African report, it kind of leveraged the knowledge and insight from teams of researchers from four separate universities. That's University of Oxford and Manchester in the UK, and the University of Cape Town and Western Cape in South Africa. This is also the third iteration of the report, so it kind of gives us an idea of how these gig economy platforms have performed over the past few years. And yeah, so they released their ratings report. I think also it might be good to just explain how these ratings are weighted. So each platform, they rated 11 in total, are scored out of 10. There are five different areas in which they are rated. That's going to be pay, the conditions, contracts, management, and representation. So 1 point is allocated if they meet the base requirement. And their second point is allocated per category if they go above and beyond, perhaps announce something innovative that actually is of benefit to the workers. So looking at the 2021 report, one of the major insights was that locally owned and led gig economy platforms fared far better than their international counterparts. And I guess that's to be expected. We've seen the likes of Facebook, at Google, and others kind of struggle as far as localization is concerned. A lot of their rules and policies they put together are always US focused and not necessarily take into account what is happening at a local level or what the situations are. So if we kind of look through the list that the Fair Work Project gave to us, the big names, I guess, so Uber Eats, Bolt, those did not fare well. So Uber and Uber Eats got 4 respectively. Uber, I think, was at 4 the previous year, and Uber Eats was at 3. So there was some marginal improvement on the Uber Eats part. I think that has a lot to do with the PPE that was provided and some of the measures that are put in place for drivers and couriers around the time of the pandemic. But that's really it. Bolt has fared really poorly. It got 1 out of 10. Which is not great. On the other end of the spectrum, locally owned and led organizations like Get Todd, Sweep South got 9 and 8, No Sweat, M4Jam, which was surprising. Money for Jam, well, I don't know if it's still called Money for Jam, but
it's
M4Jam.
Just M4Jam now.
Yeah, I'm surprised that's still around. I don't really use it much after it's like a launch a few years back. Mr. D, which is a rival to Uber Eats, a local one. That got 7 out of 10, which is obviously a lot higher than the 4 out of 10 that Uber Eats got. So like I said, the report is certainly showing that locally owned and led organizations are faring far better than their, I guess, international counterparts.
I am not surprised in the least. Well, I mean, it's nice to see local companies are getting it right, but I'm not surprised that the international firms aren't faring well, especially the likes of Uber and Bolt. And I think that the reason I say this largely comes down to the fact that the presence in these companies, or the presence in the country from those companies, is woeful. For instance, Uber Eats does have representation in South Africa, but the way in which the service and platform works is really just a carbon copy of how it works everywhere else in the world. The amount that drivers get to take home is very low. Ride prices don't shift with the petrol price, which they really should, considering how often that price changes. Things like safety are kind of, they feel like they are afterthoughts when it comes to Uber. And yeah, I'm really not surprised that they didn't do well here, because it kind of tells me that they don't have the representation they need in this country in order to look out for their workers as much as they do. That having been said, I mean, Uber is notorious for kind of putting its driver partners at the kind of back of the queue and putting customers first, because obviously that's where they make their money. And the drivers who want benefits and stuff like that are left to wait and protest and go to courts at expense to themselves. And yeah, I'm not surprised that they didn't do well in this report.
I have to wonder if those companies would do better to just listen to the employees that are here, because it, on paper, okay, it makes sense that they are worse because they don't know the conditions. But if you think about it for a while, you think, but wait, they have full representation here. Why don't they just speak to the people about improving things? And the answer is probably because improving things means less money. And when they look at a place like South Africa, where they probably aren't making, you know, they're probably making a lot of money, but they're not making as much money as bigger countries with more favorable currencies and bigger markets and stuff like that. So yeah, it makes sense when you think about it for a little bit, because they'll make less money and that rules everything.
Well, I think it goes to show, like, especially with the case of Uber, it's only recently in the UK that drivers in that area were able to get a win. And that was only after a lot of lobbying as far as the trade union goes. I mean, even in Uber and Lyft's technical HQ in California, they struggled immensely and they failed to kind of get greater representation for their drivers. So it's really unsurprising that South Africa, that company in particular, is really struggling to kind of meet the needs of its workers.
What I also just want to mention, or what I would love to know, is where Uber, Bolt, and all of these firms scored their points. Because 4 is really low, and considering how you explained it, that you get 1 point for beating the bare minimum and a second point if you go above and beyond, I'd really like to know where Uber scored its points, because fair pay, I have a big question mark over that. Fair conditions, I have another big question mark over that. So the last two would be fair contracts. Fair management and fair representation. I don't know about those other three, but I'd be really curious to see where they scored their points.
Well, let's see.
I think as far as ride-hailing services go, I think there are a lot of myths as far as what it enables. So one of the findings from the report was that almost all platforms operating in South Africa pay at least the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. However, when workers' expenses, such as petrol, transport costs, and waiting times were taken into account, evidence could only be found that 6 of the 11 platforms paid workers above the minimum wage. Only 3 of the platforms included in the ranking demonstrated evidence of workers earning above the current living wage of 41 rand an hour. So stuff like petrol, transport costs, and waiting times, that specifically talks to ride-hailing services. So chances are that those services did not score well in this report.
Well, I mean, it's also like a service like Sweep South, for instance, right? The person who's coming to clean your house has to get there somehow. So that needs to be put in or taken into account when paying them, right? So I would hope that Sweep South has taken that into consideration, though I would err on the side that they have, being a local company and understanding that getting to work and the time it takes you to get to work are things that you should be compensated for. And those ultimately eat into your final take-home pay. I would guess that a lot of those companies, or the top three that pay their worker, or the three that pay their workers over 41 rand an hour, I would guess that they are South African. I'm happy to be proven wrong, but I would guess that they are the South African ones.
Something that I also want to mention is just the way that these things are sometimes advertised to people who may be looking at them for work, because, you know, out of the blue on Instagram, I've been getting a lot of adverts for not Uber Eats, just regular Uber. And the way it's worded is so deceptive, because it says, you know, our successful, I can't remember the exact wording, but I remember the figure specifically. It says up to 8,000 Rand per week, which sounds amazing, right? That would be much higher than the average that a lot of people in South Africa earn, but 8,000 Rand a week, sure. But how much are you paying in petrol? How much are you paying to Uber's cut? How much are you paying for wear and tear on the car? It's such a deceptive figure. I mean, what's the point of earning 8,000 Rand a week if you pay 7,500 of that to the various sources? You know, Uber, petrol, wear and tear, tax, all of that. I'm not saying it is 7,500. I'm not saying that's the actual cut. I'm saying just think about it in that context, because, I mean, that's the difference between income and profit, right?
Yeah.
You can have all the income in the world, but once you take away your costs, it can be a pittance. So that advert, I really have a problem with that advert. It's not incorrect. It's just a useless figure in isolation. 8,000 Rand per week sounds so good.
I mean, it does. And I think that the other side of that as well is that, I mean, you mentioned it, Clinton, is that you need to pay for your vehicle, which likely, more than likely, you are paying off in some way or another. And also that figure, I think, is the height of what you can earn. I'm pretty sure that the Uber drivers who were operating during lockdown weren't earning 8,000 Rand a day, or a week rather. Like, there are so many things that need to be considered with these or gig economy jobs that just don't match a South African frame of mind, to my mind. You know, like I mentioned, the petrol price thing. Like, that is something that would directly affect the price of transport everywhere else in the country. And yet Uber's like, oh, well, you know, it doesn't fall within our once yearly price review, so we're just not going to do it. And it feels bad, right? Especially if you're taking an Uber that's like just down the road, or, you know, because you've had one too many to drink. Like, I feel bad if I take an Uber that's really cheap, because I know that this guy is, or this person rather, let me not genderize them, but I know that this person has to pay for the fuel to get to me. They have to pay to maintain their vehicle, because if their vehicle isn't up to scratch, then they can get kicked off of Uber. And it just feels so such a combative workspace for something that is advertised as a really simple, cheap way, or simple way to start your own business. And it's kind of like Clinton says, it's not wrong. It's just a really shady way of presenting it.
Yeah, I don't know how any of these services can be profitable, because I, like many people, when we were allowed to order food and have it delivered, I did do that because it's safer for me. That's just me personally. But I don't understand. I would use Mr. Delivery a lot, not because of this report or anything, but because they would usually send me some kind of voucher. And that's not just me, you know, as a journalist. They send it to everybody if you have a registered account. So whenever they send a deal, like a 2-for-1 deal or something like that, that was really compelling, I'd be like, oh, yeah, that's a good deal. And most of the time, the cut for the driver slash Mr. Delivery was only like 10 Rand. Yeah. And I don't understand how that's possible. I know how much petrol costs when I go fill it up. I know, you know, that you're supposed to, for every Rand you spend on petrol, you're supposed to put a Rand into the bank for repairs and replacements. Mm. But how are they doing that on 10 Rand? And I just don't think they are. And that's why I should always tip. And I don't want to get into the whole tipping culture discussion slash argument right now, but I do tip, and usually the tip is more than the fee of the delivery. And I understand I'm ordering from restaurants that are close to me because that's the one that will have the lowest delivery cost. But 10 Rand, it just can't be profitable.
Yeah. I mean, it can't be sustainable, much less profitable for the people who are working for these places, right? I mean, I feel like
all of this is just so temporary.
Yeah, and I do the same as you, Clinton. When I order Uber or something like that, I will purposefully tip more than, you know, the 20% or whatever you should tip. Like Clinton said, let's not get into that discussion. But I purposefully pay more because in my mind, just personally, I don't think that I would be able to make a delivery with 10 rands worth of fuel. Get out of here. Yeah. And then I still got to feed my family. I got to pay for maintenance of the vehicle. No, that's just ridiculous.
Here's a hot tip for everybody. Tip your driver in cash so they don't have to give a portion of the tip to the company. That's a hot tip for me. I don't know what the stance is. I remember there was a big kerfuffle about that a while back where if you paid them a tip, the tip would get a percentage going to the app. Just cut out the middleman. Give them the tip in cash. I don't keep a lot of cash on hand at all. I see no point. But this is one of the points where you should.
Yeah.
Give them to cash, baby.
So I'm just looking here very quickly at especially things like UIF and sick pay and that sort of stuff. And the fact that that's also not something that's considered in South Africa, well, at least by some of these organizations. Do we think that these are things that these companies should be providing to the folks that join their platforms?
Well, that's something I actually wanted to ask Robin before we started. Robin, in the report, I did read much of the report, but I might have missed it. Do they talk about these companies? Did they factor this in at all, that they're not usually considered employees and they're usually considered contractors with less benefits? Did they mention that at all?
Yeah, so they spoke specifically around, at least locally, Uber's being currently sued by drivers for that very reason, that they're not being recognized as workers, but they're just contractors. They also kind of reckon that the outlook for that is probably very poor, that they are not going to get what they want, given the precedent of what's happened across the globe. Mm. That said, the Fair Work Project is trying to put together a framework as far as an enforceable code for basic worker rights goes. Whether or not the international companies are willing to engage remains to be seen. It looks like a lot of the locally led ones, and I know we mentioned it a few times already, but locally led ones seem to be more willing. They seem to be engaging GetTod, which is a freelance, I guess,
handyman. They do like maintenance stuff. You can get a plumber or a builder or a landscapologist. Yeah.
Oh, apologies. I was confusing it with No Sweat. My apologies. Yeah. So it seems like those kind of companies, companies that have scored well on the Fair Work report, are looking to engage more. Those that aren't scoring well don't seem to care much at all at this stage, and that's really the unfortunate thing, is that something like Uber, which will likely have a larger pool of workers within its ranks compared to something like GetTod or No Sweat, they are the ones that really need to be looking at this as opposed to other companies.
I just want to add something, Brendan, to your question about should these benefits be offered. Lack of benefit is not at all constrained to this work environment. If I think of all my friends who are my age, which is, you know, just under 30, almost all of them don't get a lot of benefits from work. No medical aid, no this, no that. They do have some basic things like some sick pay and stuff, but the stuff that is really important. Like, medical aid is not covered. I think I have one friend who landed a very cushy job through, through nepotism. There's no other way to say it. I think they're the only person my age who I know who has those really plush benefits. And I'm very jealous. And I'm not bringing it up just to complain. I just want to point out, this isn't at all constrained to the gig economy. A lot of people who have contracts full-time, 8 or 9 to 5 every day, every day for years, they must have been at the place for years. They don't even have those benefits. So it's definitely not constrained to this economy, this portion of the economy.
So we've spoken a lot about Uber and Uber Eats, which have scored really low. But we haven't mentioned the company that scored zero. That means they scored nothing. Nothing of theirs is good. And that company is called Secret Agent. And I'd never heard about it until this report. And
basically, you've never heard of Secret Agent?
Never heard of Secret Agent. Pretty good name.
Yeah.
Pretty good name. But basically what it is, it's a mystery shopping app. And you get paid to visit a shop and complete a questionnaire, and then you get paid. It seems like something that's, those folks that spend all of their time in shopping malls while the rest of us are working during the week. It seems like it would be perfect for them, but, I mean, zero. Like, you don't get any points. That's pretty bad. Did they mention why this was included or why they scored so low, Robin?
Yeah, so Secret Agent wasn't one of the, companies that was really zeroed in on. Purely for the fact that I think for a lot of the media that was attending the webinar were unaware of it, myself included. I had no idea who Secret Agent was until I looked it up myself. So, I think the bigger, quote-unquote bigger platforms are the ones that took up much of the focus. You kind of touched on companies that did well. I was quite interested to see that Bolt only scored one. Mm. And they're one of the companies that have been doing a few... Yes, initiatives as far as the protection of its drivers and its users go. So, yeah, I was really interested to see that they only scored one, considering they seem to have been doing more things than your Ubers or Mr. D's have been doing.
See, I wonder if that's not linked to Bolt's more affordable nature, because rides on Bolt are generally cheaper than through Uber. And I wonder if that doesn't affect the payouts of their driver partners. I'm sure that they will have some effect. The other side of that as well is that Bolt isn't available in as many cities as something like Uber. So maybe that affected the payout as well. Or it could be that the people they interviewed used Bolt and Uber interchangeably. Who knows? Unfortunately, we're kind of guessing in the dark here because we weren't there when the surveys were conducted. So,
yeah, we only have the report to go on, and every report will have some problems.
Yeah,
even though they had universities and everything involved in this, it's all good and well to read these reports and everything, but it's something completely different to actually work for these companies. I'm not evangelizing or standing up for anything, but maybe like. Somebody who has done work for, say, Uber and Bolt or whatever, and has come back and said, even though this company scored lower, I prefer working for them for X, Y, and Z, is two completely different things. I think this is just a very generalized report.
Yeah.
And I think it's good information to have, but like with anything, it's not the full picture.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point, Clinton, is that it's a good thing to have to reference if you are going to make use of these services. Might be better to spend your money with a company that is doing a better job of working with their partners. For instance, like Mr. D seems to be a better company to go for than Uber Eats. Unfortunately, you might not have access to both. And that's the other side of things, right? Is that you might not have access to one of these services and you're kind of forced to use them, and that turns it into a grudge purchase, and yeah, it's a bit of a mess. So my question is the gig economy flourishing in South Africa, or does it still have a ways to go? In my opinion, I think that companies need to be a bit more cognizant of the African situation. That is things like
petrol costs, transport costs, things like that need to be factored into what workers ultimately get paid at the end of the day, whether they are contractors or freelancers or not. Unfortunately, because of South Africa's history, a lot of our residential areas or a lot of folks live in townships still, which are very far away from major metropolitan centers. So that has to be something that is considered, because we live in this place, right? We live in South Africa, and if you want to work in South Africa, you also need to take cognizance of the special, the unique situation within that country. What do you think, Robin? Is there still ways to go with the gig economy in South Africa, or are we in a good space at the moment?
So I think it depends on what you mean by thriving. So yes, as far as the number of options for gig economy platforms, that's doing really well. I think there are a nice number of options for you to choose from if you are an end user or consumer. In terms of actually working for these companies, I don't see, I'm not seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. I don't think that it long-term, the only benefits as opposed to just working, a more traditional kind of job. Mm. If you look like in more developed nations in the US and Europe, this gig economy work is often used to supplement traditional work. Mm. In South Africa, a lot of people that are using gig economy platforms are using it as their sole source of income.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably where the disparity happens. And we've spoken a bit about localization. But the model that works in Europe and UK and the US does not translate to how it works here in South Africa. We have a very different, setup here. So, yes, there are plenty of gig economy platforms. I expect more to be entering into the country now that the pandemic is still ongoing and we need more access to digital services in order to avoid contact with one another. That said, if you are working on a gig economy platform, it is tough, if not even more tougher now that the pandemic is going on and you are at greater risk, really.
Mm. Clinton?
Honestly, think in a few years we won't even have a gig economy anymore. Going back to what Robin said, if you look at other countries, if you look at Uber, that's the biggest name, right? If you look at their books, they are constantly making a massive loss, billions of dollars in loss. And that can't be sustained forever. It just can't. Now, I understand how certain startups make billions of dollars in loss for a long time and then they become profitable. You need to spend money to make money, and a lot of Silicon Valley startups do this. You lose a lot of money and then you make a lot of money. And I understand that, and I understand I'm not an accountant, but they've lost so much money over so much time while also treating the drivers bad that I just don't see how this that can continue. You know, what's the saying? The runway is going to run out eventually. It has to end soon. I really think that in maybe 10 years, we'll look back at this and think, how did we let them get away with it for so long? The prices were so little, people were making so little money. The only real people who are benefiting is the end users. And I can say that as an end user, I really don't think this has much life left. Maybe it will drag on for a few more years. I think eventually we're going to go back to big restaurant chains will have their own drivers, which they already do sometimes, and we'll go back to taxi cabs. I think we're just going to do a complete, 360, return to where we started. It's just not profitable enough. Someone came up with an idea and it worked maybe in one or two cities, and then it expanded and then it just made a massive loss in total. And I think that's where it's eventually going to head it. You know, I'd love to be proven wrong. Like Robin said, a lot of people depend on this as their sole source of income, and I don't want to see anyone out on the streets. But I just don't see how they're ever going to turn a proper profit to keep this going as a legitimate, function of the economy.
Just to jump on something you said there, Clinton, about the in a couple of years we won't be doing this anymore. Something that I've always found rather interesting is the idea of a bidding network where essentially I would
go onto an application and say, I need to get to OR Tambo Airport. I'm willing to pay $500. Who wants to take the ride? Yeah. And essentially auction off what I need to do to the lowest bidder.
Yeah.
And I really like that idea because in that instance, the driver, well, in a perfect instance of that example, the driver would get the full amount of money. Obviously, there's the question about who's going to develop the platform, who's going to pay for maintenance, all that sort of stuff. But in a perfect world, that's how something like this would operate. I would need to do something. I would put it out somewhere and somebody would pay for it, or would I would pay somebody to do it and they would bid for it. I mean, that seems like a really complicated process, and I think that's possibly why a solution like this hasn't taken off, because things like Uber are so easy. You literally just open an app and say, I want to go here, and in 5 minutes there's somebody at your door to pick you up. So I think where these services have flourished is in the ease of use. It's really easy to order food through Uber Eats. It's so much more complicated to pick up the phone, talk to the place, tell them what you want, and then you have to repeat what you want because the telephone line is awful, and then you have to drive to the place to go and pick it up, or hopefully they have a delivery person. It's just messy, right? And these platforms have leveraged that by making it easier to do things. But I think a good example of this is GetTod, because GetTod is a way for you to find a person that is, let's say, a plumber, and they're within your area, they're just down the road, you can hire them. And you might not have ever found that person another way. Or you can tell me like, oh, but you know, back in the day with the Yellow Pages, and somebody had to go and put out an ad in the Yellow Pages and hope that you needed their services eventually. That's why I think GetTod kind of works, because it's like the Yellow Pages, but a little bit easier to use, while not, what's the word, not hurting the people who are actually using the platform to make money. So I think there is room for gig economy, or the gig economy, but it needs to put the people who are participating in that economy front and center rather than the platform, right? That's always something I found weird about Uber, is that the platform is this holy grail. No, mate, you just got an app. Without your drivers, you got nothing.
Yeah, the problem, that's the core of the issue. The middleman is eating all the pie.
Mm-hmm. And that's, it's really confusing.
No system can work like that, because the customer and the person supplying the service or the goods, they are supposed to be eating all the pie, not the middleman. And that's the problem with every single gig economy.
Yeah, it's essentially like you're going to Pick and Pay to do your groceries, and you get to checkout, and they tell you, oh, well, you need to pay through this service, and then that service then pays Pick and Pay a percentage of whatever you paid for your groceries.
It's more like, you know what it's more like? It's like you're going to Pick and Pay, and say your groceries come to 100 Rand, and you're paying 95 Rand to the person who puts the groceries into the bag.
Yeah.
And then the remaining 5 Rand goes to Pick and Pay and to the person working the till and for everything else. But the guy puts the stuff in the bag, gets 95 Rand.
And the other side of this is that we are talking from a South African perspective. It could be completely different in another area, another part of the world. I'm not saying that Uber works this way in London or whatever, because I don't know. But in South Africa, at least, these considerations need to be made. Because we can't have a situation where the company is taking all the money from the workers, and then they get to do that legally because they called contractors or whatever. It's just bizarre how we got to this point, right? It's like sort of like one day DLC was the laughing joke of the internet, and now it's pretty much a fixture in every single game, even those that wouldn't ever have put it in their games before. Like, it's just a bizarre way to arrive at this point.
And the big problem now is people have gotten used to it. They've gotten used to getting something delivered for 10 Rand. They've gotten used to it. So how can we ever go back? Because if you ask, I don't know how to say this, not sound heartless, but people who are using the app usually don't give a damn about the drivers. Mm. They just don't care. And if you tell them they're not making a lot and everything, they say, oh, well, my job that I work at, whatever that job is, they also treat me badly, so I don't really care. And we're going to, it's hard to talk about this and not say, you know, everyone gather on the streets and we should all become, you know, read the good book of Karl Marx. So it's hard to talk about all of this without devolving quickly into that. But that's how it is. People have gotten used to things being cheap and fast. And if you combine convenience with low prices, people will always choose that. It's the reason Amazon has become so big in America, even though it mistreats everyone who is involved. And now we can't go back because consumers are just that they've come to expect a certain level of service at a certain price. And how do we go back? Now, for the gig economy, we might have to go back because, like I said, those companies are billions of dollars in debt. Retail is a completely different story because, unlike that, Amazon is making a lot of money. How much of that is for web services and not actual Amazon? Again, that's another huge conversation, but I just don't know how we go back without there being a lot of pushback from the consumers.
Yeah, I think we're going to wrap this up. We've been crowing a lot over the last 50 minutes or so. So just to wrap up, closing thoughts. Robin, what are your final thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think, and this might be a little Chinese or Indian in terms of my thinking, but if international companies are going to operate in South Africa, they need to do so with South Africans in mind. Yeah. That's the only way that this thing works.
Absolutely. Clinton?
Yeah, you know that tax that these companies paid? Maybe the government can use some of that tax to put some oversight to protect the workers. That would be great. Imagine a government that looks out for the citizens of the country it governs. That would be great. And maybe they can use the tax they all charge us to pay for that oversight.
Considering that our police force waited until the last possible moment to arrest somebody this week, I would say that's wishful thinking.
That's been wishful thinking ever since democracy was invented. Damn Greeks.
My closing thoughts are quite simple. If you work in South Africa or you operate in South Africa, you need to actually operate in South Africa. You can't copy and paste your business model that you used in San Francisco and place it in South Africa. It does not work. We are a different place. We have different ideologies. It's a different culture. It's a different way that we spend our money, different ways that our money is used. So you need to take that into consideration. And I think that some companies really do take that to heart, but others, as we've seen in the Fair Work reports, just don't. And that's a bit sad. Also, secret agents, please do better. I don't even know how you scored so low, but you need to do a little bit more than whatever it is you are doing right now. Even just a minuscule amount more work would probably get you a higher rating. It's a cool idea. Secret agent. But that's going to wrap it up from us for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you again to ASUS for sponsoring this AfriCast. My name is Brendan Lotz. Thank you for tuning in. And Clinton Matos.
It's also still Clinton Matos. Goodbye, everybody.
And Robin Lichetti.
Take care, everyone.
We'll see you next week. Get the most out of your ASUS ZenBook 15 with MyASUS. With this software, you can optimize your notebook's performance, change cooling profiles, contact after-sales support, and even multitask using your iOS or Android smartphone. For more information and to get your ZenBook 15, visit www.asus.com.